Carolina says he spoke with federal officials and Border Patrol agents are coming soon. That's all the community has of details. So how's it preparing? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Many Democrats disagree with Senator Jeanne Shaheen's vote to reopen the government, but one has an open line of communication. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Stephanie Shaheen explains how her position differs from her mother's. Also, new research quantifies how much ultra-processed foods increase cancer risk in adults under 50. It's Friday, November 14th. On this day in 1889, Nellie Bly set out to break the record of the fictional Phileas Fogg, who made it around the world in 80 days. The real journalist beat him by over a week. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Watchdog groups led by former Park Service employees say the government shutdown has worsened the funding and environmental crisis at national parks. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports the Trump administration ordered most national parks to stay open with a skeleton staff.
Thousands of furloughed National Park Service employees are now returning to work after the 43-day shutdown. Many entrance gates at parks remained open but unstaffed. And one estimate by watchdog groups predicts the service may have lost upwards of $40 million in entrance fee revenue. This is a big deal because it follows cuts to the agency ordered by President Trump and his DOGE team. Since January, the Park Service lost a quarter of its entire staff, from scientists to janitors to rangers. Meanwhile, the return of the remaining staff is seen as a relief following reports of vandalism of artifacts at Arches National Park in Utah, base jumpers off El Capitan at Yosemite, and damage to a stone wall at historic Gettysburg. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
The House is moving ahead with a vote to release all files from the investigation into convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Republican leaders have agreed to bring it to the floor after a petition reached the required 218 signatures. The push comes as new documents revive questions about Epstein and his associates, including emails mentioning President Trump. The White House accuses Democrats of leaking emails to smear him. New research links high consumption of ultra-processed foods to early-onset colorectal cancer. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the research suggests diet is one factor behind the increase in colon cancer among young adults.
Doctors at Mass General Brigham Cancer Institute analyzed data from nearly 30,000 female nurses under the age of 50. They found those who ate more ultra-processed foods, including salty, high-fat snacks, such as chips and sugary drinks, had a significantly higher risk of developing precancerous polyps. Dr. Andrew Chan is an author of the study.
If you have a family history, certainly if you have a history of polyps, trying to kind of adjust what you eat is one step you can take.
Not all processed foods are unhealthy, but increasingly research shows a diet high in saturated fat, sodium, and sugar, as is found in many packaged foods, increases the risk of chronic disease. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Blue Origin launched its Glenn rocket on Thursday with a pair of NASA spacecraft destined for Mars. The company recovered the booster following its separation from the upper stage and the Mars orbiters, an essential step to recycle and slash costs similar to SpaceX. This is NPR. The American Psychological Association has released a health advisory about AI chatbots to address mental health needs. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
A recent U.S. survey found that nearly 50% of people with a mental health condition who use AI chatbots use them for psychological support. But the new advisory notes that most AI chatbots were not designed to treat psychological disorders, and so consumers should not use them to replace mental health care from a trained provider. AI apps and chatbots can create a false sense of therapeutic relationship, with some chatbots falsely claiming that they are licensed therapists. The report also points out that several AI chatbots have engaged vulnerable youth in harmful interactions, encouraging them to self-harm and even attempt suicide. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
More than 1,000 unionized Starbucks workers walked off the job at dozens of stores in more than 40 cities on Thursday. Michelle Eisen is a barista and spokesperson for the Union Starbucks Workers United. She says they're protesting pay and working conditions.
In terms of how and how long we're willing to go and what workers are willing to do, I can tell you that workers are committed to escalating as needed if the company does not come back with some solutions.
Starbucks says that fewer than 4% of its workers in its 10,000 company-owned stores are unionized. On Wall Street, Dow futures are trading lower at this hour. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
September 1918. It was James Douglas Falconer's first day as a druggist at Rexall Drugstore in Marshall, Minnesota. Just a year before, he'd married Borghild Rigg, a 26-year-old from Glenwood. Then, just 2 months ago, she died. So when the position in Marshall opened up, he took it. In the very month Spanish influenza first appeared in Minnesota. Suddenly, Falconer and his colleagues at the drugstore found themselves on the front lines of the epidemic. Customers waited in line to fill prescriptions, which didn't cure the flu. Nothing could in an era before the discovery of viruses, but they could at least alleviate symptoms. That didn't stop customers from snapping up Epsom salts, aspirin, and quinine, looking for that alleged miracle cure. Meanwhile, Falconer put in long hours. In December of 1918, a professional journal for pharmacists listed the Minnesota druggist who, like their customers, had been stricken or died from the flu. Among the names was James Douglas Falconer, who died October 21st, just a month after starting his new job.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The sheriff in Charlotte, North Carolina, says the Trump administration has selected that city for its next immigration crackdown.
Now, Charlotte is in Mecklenburg County, and the county sheriff there says federal officials have told him that agents could arrive as soon as tomorrow, and that's all he knows. This is happening as some Border Patrol agents are leaving Chicago after weeks of aggressive raids.
Magdala Canal with member station WFAE in Charlotte has been following developments and joins us now. Nick, what do we know so far about agents coming to Charlotte?
Well, we first started hearing reports a few days ago that this could be happening, but city officials said they were completely in the dark. And then yesterday, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff, Gary McFadden, said he was contacted by two federal officials who told him Border Patrol agents will be arriving, possibly Saturday or early next week. Now, there's still a lot that we don't know, like how many agents are coming, how long they plan to stay, what their assignment is, although perhaps we could look to Chicago as a precedent. The sheriff, who is a Democrat, said he's not getting involved in any possible operation, and Charlotte police put out a statement saying they don't participate with federal immigration enforcement. We did reach out to the Department of Homeland Security, and they told us they don't comment on potential operations.
Okay, so very little detail. How is the community reacting?
Well, there's definitely fear, even though advocacy groups have been urging calm. I spoke with Daniela Andrade with the Carolina Migrant Network, and she says that their ICE hotline has been ringing off the hook over the last few days, mostly with false reports.
People have been calling, reporting anything they see on the street, which sometimes might be just CMPD or something completely different. Most of these cases right now are not ICE, but it's just that fear in general that's already in our community.
And CMPD is the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, by the way. Also, some Latino businesses shared photos on social media yesterday of empty parking lots in what are normally bustling immigrant shopping centers.
And what are local officials telling people?
Charlotte Mayor Vi-Lyles has released a statement saying that the city is committed to following the law while protecting civil rights. Some city council members are also speaking up, including a councilman-elect, J.D. Mazuera Arias, who himself is an immigrant. He told his community to take a deep breath, not to keep kids home from school or skip work out of fear. And he says Customs and Border Protection need to be transparent with residents and law enforcement.
Our community deserves clarity. The sheriff's department deserves clarity. If there is an operation or presence in Charlotte, the public has the right to know what's happening and why it's happening.
So that question of why, do you have any idea why Border Patrol agents are heading to Charlotte or appear to be heading there?
Yeah, we really don't have any idea. We have seen ICE arrests in Charlotte, like in other cities. There was a workplace raid this summer and some isolated arrests, but never Border Patrol agents, as far as we know. Now, the city did draw national attention earlier this fall following the fatal stabbing of a Ukrainian woman on the light rail. The suspect was not an immigrant, however. Republicans and the White House directed a lot of criticism at the city's Democratic mayor for that. And there have been calls for the National Guard, even though violent crime is down 20% over last year.
Nick De La Canal with member station WFAE. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Let's turn to a lifelong resident of Mecklenburg County, George Dunlap, who is chairman of the County Board of Commissioners, also a law enforcement and military veteran. Mr. Chairman, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you for joining us early. What is the immigrant community in Charlotte like? How diverse is the city?
Well, the city is very diverse. In fact, it is a majority and minority community when you add the immigrant community and the African-American community. It makes up the majority of the city.
And we just heard from Nick De La Canal of immigrant shopping centers, which I can picture. I mean, the shopping center where immigrants are commonly there, and then that the parking lots are empty. What are you hearing from that community?
Well, there's a lot of concern because people don't know what to anticipate. They don't know what to expect. And of course, they're on edge. As a result of that, you have kids staying home from school. You have people who are not going to work. It's just people are on pins and needles.
And just so I understand where people come from, I mean, do you have an idea of some of the countries that you would find a large community from in your city?
Well, most I think are Hispanic, so they come from places like Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, you name it. They come from everywhere.
What is the level of local law enforcement cooperation generally with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
I don't really think there's any cooperation. I think more than anything, local law enforcement is getting out of their way. I think we recognize that they have law enforcement powers, law enforcement duties, and nobody wants to interfere with that. I think the biggest concern is that the way they carry out their actions is done in such a way that it intimidates people. It is overpowering. It gives law enforcement in general a bad name.
I was just looking at a list of American cities according to their crime rates, and Charlotte, Mecklenburg, it ain't so high. You're 128th on this list. So, I mean, I'm sure there's crime in Charlotte, but you don't seem that high crime. How do you feel about the crime rate and the general public safety situation there?
Well, everybody has crime. And crime can be seasonal. It could change with the season. It is also crimes of passion, things that you can't control no matter where you are in the city. But I agree that in terms of overall crime, we have nowhere the crime that lots of other cities. And if the focus is on crime, then there are other cities where the use of ICE or Border Patrols could be better utilized.
Why do you suppose then that Charlotte would be chosen for the next city to target after Los Angeles and Chicago and some others?
Well, if you look at the pattern, it appears that it's based solely on the political makeup of the community and nothing else. Because a lot of Democrats do hold a significant amount of power in terms of politics, then I think this became the focus. But, you know, I think the American public really ought to be upset at the fact that we're spending taxpayer dollars for border patrol. There are no borders in Mecklenburg County. So maybe they asked for a bunch of money and they really don't need it. So now they're looking for something to use the money for. And so they have all these border patrols going throughout the country and intimidating and terrorizing communities that for the most part are safe and people get along.
If you got a call from the President of the United States and he said, listen, I do have these resources, I'm sending them there, tell me what is needed to be done. Is there any advice you would give the President about what to do or not to do?
You know, in all fairness, you have to say, if you did what you told the American public you were going to do, people probably would not be concerned. If you focused on the most violent criminals in our community who were not supposed to be here in the first place, people probably wouldn't question that. But they're coming like what's in the bag, just shaking things up. That's unfair, breaking up communities and breaking up families for no apparent reason other than to demonstrate that you have power and control is not a good look.
George Dunlap chairs the Board of Commissioners in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, which includes Charlotte. Mr. Chairman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
As we enter another football weekend, millions of YouTube TV subscribers will be looking for games elsewhere. A dispute with Disney has left them without access to Disney programming, including ESPN's college football. NPR's Tristan Plunkett reports.
There were signs of progress on a deal this week, but yesterday, Disney CFO Hugh Johnston gave an update on CNBC. He had news that TV and sports fans did not want to hear.
We're in the middle of negotiations right now. Things are live. They're happening. Obviously, as we entered the year, we knew this was going to be a challenging battle, and we prepared ourselves for it, and we're ready to go as long as they want to.
This came a day after The Athletic reported the media powerhouses had made progress on a deal, but there were hangups on how much YouTube TV would pay for Disney's other networks, including FX and National Geographic. YouTube TV subscribers haven't had access to Disney programming for weeks, including popular shows like Dancing with the Stars and Monday Night Football. Morgan Stanley analysts estimated that the lockout is costing Disney about $30 million a week. YouTube TV told its customers it was offering a $20 credit to help placate anger over the missing programming. It also noted its own negotiation efforts. Alphabet is the parent company of Google, which owns YouTube TV, and Google is a financial supporter of NPR. On Disney's earnings call yesterday, CEO Bob Iger said the company is working to close a deal, but said it doesn't want to devalue Disney's programming.
It's also imperative that we make sure that we agree to a deal that reflects the value that we deliver, which both YouTube, by the way, and Alphabet have told us is greater than the value of any other provider.
It's not clear what the demands are for each side, and disputes like this aren't new, including for Disney. But this now marks the longest time it has withheld its content from a carrier. It also comes after ESPN launched its own direct-to-consumer streaming service earlier this year, charging customers $30 per month. NPR reached out to both YouTube and Disney for comment. Tristan Plunkett, NPR News.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
Cream Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
This station. And from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone, at betterhelp.com/public. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Kresge Foundation, with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation. From revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change, Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Pentagon's top civilian made news earlier this year when he summoned hundreds of generals for a lecture that included remarks about their personal appearance. His critique included beards. You may be surprised by who's affected and why they have beards. Steve Walsh with WHRO in Norfolk covers the military and has this report.
In September, when Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth called top generals and admirals to Virginia, many thought he would discuss the use of troops inside the U.S. or hold the first public briefing on the operation underway in the Caribbean. Instead, they heard,
"No more beardos. The era of rampant and ridiculous shaving profiles is done. Simply put, if you do not meet the male-level physical standards for combat positions, cannot pass a PT test, or don't want to shave and look professional, it's time for a new position or a new profession."
Sailors and soldiers with pseudofolliculitis barbae took to social media. The condition leaves sores and bumps from ingrown hairs after they shave.
"As you guys can see, it's pretty bad. It's not very appealing."
"So you want me to walk around with this all over my whole face? You're like, make that make sense."
"It's people that look nothing like me, if you know what I mean, suggesting how to shave. You guys just don't understand. I'm sorry."
The skin condition primarily impacts black men. The final regulations have not been released, but there is a concern that they could be kicked out if they have a beard. Black men are not the only group worried about a ban. Arthur Zeidman is a former military lawyer and an Army Reserve officer. He works with the Aleph Institute, which offers help to Jewish members of the military. He says beards became more common in 2020.
"This was during the first Trump administration, not only to chaplains, but others who, for religious reasons, are not allowed to shave or have limitations on shaving, and they were allowed to wear beards in uniform."
It was the culmination of a long legal battle to force the military to uphold the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which originally passed in the 1990s. Muslim men could also wear beards. There was an influx of observant Jews who felt they were able to join the military for the first time, Zeidman says.
"Many of the regulations before, and they're mostly in terms of uniform regulations, had interfered with practice of a number of groups. For example, the wearing of a cross by Christians."
And the pushback isn't just about facial hair. Before he retired in 2023, Michael McGurk led civilian teams which spent a decade developing a new Army combat fitness test. He worked at Army Training and Doctrine Command when it was at Fort Eustis in Virginia. He pushes back on Hegseth's comments that standards were lowered to promote women and minorities.
"When the females went through Ranger School, the enforcement of standards, I think, actually got tougher or stricter, because they wanted to make sure that everybody that went was being held to the same exact standard."
making those elite women pass a PT test at least 70% of the male standard, the way Hegseth is demanding, won't be an issue, he says. Women who succeed in the grueling combat arms already perform above that standard.
Frankly, among the females that I know that are in the infantry or have gone through different elite training and stuff, they're like, hey, we're good with that. Bring it on.
Meanwhile, Hegseth's speech on fitness standards and grooming remains required viewing throughout the services. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
Time now for StoryCorps. Cindy Kirkhart runs the Facing Hunger Food Bank. It provides food for tens of thousands of people around Huntington, West Virginia. Scott Thompson started working at the food bank in 2021 after serving nearly 5 years in prison on drug charges.
I just got to the sober living house. I'm so fresh out of prison. And the guys were like, hey, do you want to go with us to the food bank to volunteer? And I'm like, freedom? Like, I can leave somewhere? And yes, please, you know? And I was like, I need a job. You're a felon. You better just work wherever somebody will take you. And this place might actually hire me.
Mm-hmm. What was your first impression of me?
You interviewed me. And I was very intimidated because I thought you were so fierce. You can own a room the second you walk into it. But you offered me a job in the warehouse. Just let me get my foot in the door somewhere. So why did you decide to give me a chance?
Because I believed in you. I really have a strong belief that we all have a gift that we're sent to share with the world. When I was a kid, I never knew we were poor. But I knew that our cupboard would be empty before my mom got paid. And sometimes someone would come and knock on the door, and when we went to open the door, there would be a box of food.
Yeah.
Someone's kindness made a difference. That's what's led me to where I am. And I think you had that too.
Through the majority of my childhood, I lived right next door to my grandfather, who was every bit of a role model. He would pull me out of school to go deliver food boxes to families in need. And my family members tell me, if your grandpa was alive, he'd be beside himself because he raised me and trained me to do what I'm doing. I wish I would have started sooner. Thank you for giving me purpose. When you decided to give me my chance, you changed the entire trajectory of my life. I don't just get up and go to work every day. I get up and feed people every day. And it's so much more than a job. And I'm glad and I'm honored to be in the position to help you do it.
Well, it's my honor as well.
Thank you.
Scott Thompson and Cindy Kirkhart of the Facing Hunger Food Bank in Huntington, West Virginia. They're planning to distribute at least 100,000 meals this holiday season. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from Subaru, featuring the 2026 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness.
This is NPR News.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono's message of nonviolence is pretty well known.
I think it's as simple as peace and love, you know.
I'm Elsa Chang. John and Yoko's son, Sean Ono Lennon, talks with me about what's less understood about his famous parents, especially his mom. And we get into the new documentary, One to One, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. It's 5:29. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for being here on the Friday morning show. Coming up, we'll get our daily dose of phenology. Also want to remind you that Phenology Nature's Season Watch, the new podcast this week, is out. can find it at our website, kaxc.org, or if you've already subscribed, you'll find it on your podcast device. Would that be your phone? That would be your phone. Mostly sunny skies for our day today. Could get up to 60, especially in like the Brainerd area, but 54 to 60 around the region. South winds 10 to 20 miles an hour. Evening lows in the mid-30s to low 40s. And mostly sunny tomorrow. Highs 40 to 46 degrees. This Sunday, the Bemidji Symphony Orchestra presents Pathway to Dignity. It's at 3 p.m. at the Bemidji High School Auditorium. They're going to be accepting donations of new or gently used gloves, socks, hats, and scarves that will be distributed to several nonprofit organizations. And the Great Lakes Area Performing Arts are holding auditions for the Tin Woodman of Oz, November 17th and 18th from 6 to 9, both nights at Pequot Lakes High School Auditorium. And going on, Itasca Housing Resource Team is hosting Soup on the Street next Wednesday on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5. Stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves are going to be accepted, and soup will be served. The Bemidji Area Arts Endowment is hosting a fundraiser. That is tomorrow night at 7 at the Loft. Arts Shines Bright will feature an evening of entertainment with modern dance, instrumental and vocal performances, a theatrical production, and more. Get tickets through the Northwest Minnesota Foundation, NWMF.org. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, November 14th, 2006, I get a report of a varied thrush in Britt, Minnesota. Varied thrushes are birds of the West, and if you've ever been out to Glacier National Park or just out in the Western Mountains, you have no doubt heard and seen these birds. They look a lot like a robin, except that where the robin would have a red breast from chin to tail feathers, the varied thrush has a red breast with a broad black bib that kind of cuts across the front of its breast. And that marks a difference between the two. Now, the varied thrush, if it shows up at your house, is unlikely to leave, probably going to stay for most of the winter if you continue to provide it with feed. But I have never heard of a varied thrush spending its entire year or life here in northern Minnesota. They somehow get blown in here off of a winter storm coming from the west, and they stay until, well, as late as April, but not much after that. I've never had a report of a varied thrush sticking around into May or June.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire was a lead negotiator between several members of her party and Republicans to end the shutdown. Stephanie Shaheen is her daughter and one of seven Democrats running for a House seat in New Hampshire, and she also publicly disagreed with her mother's consequential vote to reopen the government. We called her this morning to ask why. Good morning, Stephanie, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning, Leila. Thank you so much for having me today.
I want to start with why you don't support the deal that your mother ultimately negotiated.
Sure. Well, you know, the fact is that improving health care has been the cause of my life. It became that when my eldest daughter, Ellie, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was just 8 years old. Mm-hmm. It's the reason I got into this race to improve and fight for better health care that's more affordable. And so when Speaker Johnson stated that he couldn't guarantee a vote to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits, I knew it was a deal I could not support in the House.
At any point during the actual conversations over the deal, when your mom was negotiating it, did you ever tell her, don't go through with it, and here's why?
Well, you know, I knew where she stood. She knew where I stood. She ultimately did what she thinks is right, and I'm doing what I think is right. And ultimately, what's right is to ensure that we turn this anger into action, and we demand that Speaker Johnson bring a vote to the floor to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits.
So when you say turn this anger into action, I mean, for anyone using the federal health care exchanges, out-of-pocket premium payments are expected to more than double without subsidies. In New Hampshire's first congressional district, where you are running for office, there are more than 36,000 people who get their health insurance through the ACA marketplace. What are they telling you about what they want from Congress, and what are you telling them you will do if you get elected on this matter?
Sure. Well, the first thing we have to do is extend these tax credits. You know, the fact is Republicans have made it pretty easy for them to extend their tax breaks to the billionaire friends they represent, and they're struggling very hard to figure out how to extend tax credits for the millions of Americans who need health care. The rising cost of health care in New Hampshire, a family of four can expect to see their premiums increase almost $7,000 next year if these tax credits don't get extended. It's simply unattainable. It's not affordable. And these costs, on top of all the other expenses people are trying to navigate right now with inflation, the rising cost of food, the rising cost of housing, it can't keep going this way. We have to ensure we get these tax credits extended. And then beyond that, that's just the start of the fight. Then beyond that, we've got to do everything in our power to improve health care. We've got lots of ways of doing that. I think the first most important step is that in the next 6 weeks, we have to get these tax credits extended. And so I invite all your listeners to check out our website and join us in this fight, StephanieShaheen.com, for the advocacy work we're going to need to do between now and the end of December. And let's be clear, we have to get these tax credits extended before January, because that's when the premiums go up.
Now, the deal that passed, that reopened the government, didn't include any long-term commitment, as you mentioned, from Republicans to extend health care subsidies. But your mother noted about her vote that she thought the things that it did include were important, making sure federal workers got rehired and paid, food benefits got restored, that these were more important things, and it's what the Democrats could get. I mean, do you agree?
Well, I think ultimately the Senate is going to get a vote on the extension of the tax credits. And we need Speaker Johnson to guarantee the same thing. You know, being in a position
where wasn't that part of the deal originally? Like, it doesn't matter if the Senate does it, if the House doesn't.
Well, and that's why I had to speak out against it, because we have to have a vote in the House. You know, ultimately, being in a position where we're having to choose between sick kids and hungry kids is not a good place to be, and we have to make sure we still have time to channel this anger into action and get a vote in the House. The fight continues, and I think the fight has to be focused right now on doing everything in our power to make sure there's a bill that comes out of the Senate to extend the ACA tax credits, and that we get the House to do the same before the end of December.
Is there a place for common ground between Democrats and Republicans on rising health care costs? Because it is something that is acknowledged on both sides of the aisle.
There has to be. And, you know, part of that is my motivation in getting into this race. We collectively have to stand up and fight for what's right. And we know the health and well-being of the American people has to come first. So I am certain there's common ground here, and it can start with everyone agreeing to extend these tax credits before the end of December.
Stephanie Shaheen is running to become a member of the U.S. House. She's the daughter of Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen and disagrees with her vote on this deal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some new research suggests a link between eating lots of ultra-processed foods and the risk of colorectal cancer. Researchers say that may help explain the increase in colon cancer among adults in their 30s and 40s. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
A gastroenterologist at Mass General Brigham in Boston, Dr. Andrew Chan, became concerned when he started to notice a trend.
I would say about 15 years ago, I really started to notice that the patients I was taking care of that had colorectal cancer were getting younger and younger.
He and his colleagues decided to do some research. They analyzed the diets of nearly 30,000 female nurses.
The women that consumed the highest level of ultra-processed food had about a 1.5-fold higher risk of developing a precancerous polyp compared to those women that consumed the lowest amount of ultra-processed food.
Polyps can be removed before a cancer develops, but they were surprised to see so many in a population of young women.
The type of polyps that these women were at risk for, we know to be the precursor or the sort of first step towards the development of a colorectal cancer.
Ultra-processed foods are typically packaged foods with lots of ingredients, and they often contain a lot of salt, sugar, and saturated fat.
So snack foods like potato chips and cookies and things that are prepared on the shelf for people to eat quickly.
And prior research has linked soda and other sugar-sweetened drinks to colorectal cancer, too. Dr. Ben Schlechter is a senior physician at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He says there's more to learn about all the factors that play a role in the development of colorectal cancer, but diet certainly seems to be one.
Given the choice between unprocessed fruits, fruits and vegetables, low-sugar foods, healthier foods, and more active lifestyle, those are all things that are beneficial in a number of ways, and in particular, in preventing colon cancer.
He says the rise in colon cancer among young adults is striking.
For men under the age of 50, colon cancer is now the leading cause of death from cancer. And by 2030, in women under the age of 50, colon cancer is going to pass breast cancer.
The recommendation is that everyone 45 and up should be screened for colorectal cancer, and prevention can start much earlier in life with a focus on healthy habits. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community. It's 5:43. Thanks for tuning in. It's the Thursday morning show here on People Powered KAXE. We've got more coming up from Morning Edition. At 7:01 this morning, we bring you the latest local news. It's the Up North Report. United Way of a Thousand Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive. It's now through December 12th. Several drop-off sites are in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Programming on KEXE KBXE is supported in part by MinSure, offering Minnesotans the opportunity to find discounts, compare private health plans, and see if they qualify for no-cost or low-cost insurance. Expert advice is also available. The enrollment deadline is December 18th. for coverage starting January 1st. Information and enrollment are online at mnsure.org. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji weekdays from 9 to 4 o'clock. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you are a caregiver or someone with this disease, the Alzheimer Foundation of America has a helpline to provide support, answer questions, and connect you with resources. Find more info at alzfdn.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The biggest winner at the Latin Grammy Awards was an artist who has dominated the conversation about pop music all year. No, no. And I are kind of dancing in the studio here. Bad Bunny took home Album of the Year last night. NPR's Ana Maria Sayer was at the awards in Las Vegas, which means she is up ridiculously early. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
Okay, I'm glad you're with us. You know I've been listening to this album, Debí Tirar Más Fotos. I should have taken more photos. I love the title, but what's it about?
You know, it's really a coming home album for Benito. It set the tone for an entire year of Latin music, and it's basically him saying, everyone stay committed to where you're from. Specifically in his case, it's Puerto Rico, but generally it's about fighting for your home in spite of any forces that might be there trying to take it away.
Debí tirar más fotos de cuando te tuve. Debí darte más besos y abrazo las veces que pude.
Now, Steve, it's really important to note that this album came out in January, and it has managed to sustain and inform conversations across Latin America around cultural changes in the music. It's also a huge turning point for him, this win that he had last night. I mean, he's arguably one of the biggest artists in Latin America and maybe in the world. Right now, he's been one of the three most streamed artists on Spotify for each of the last 5 years, to give you the picture. But before this year, he'd only taken home trophies in the rap and urban categories at the Latin Grammys. So this was the first time he took something home in one of the big categories. He said something in his acceptance speech that I think really gets at the core of his project and a major trend that's been happening, especially this year in Latin music.
Este premio se lo quiero dedicar a todos los niños y los jóvenes de Latinoamérica, y especialmente a los de Puerto Rico.
He said that he wants to dedicate this award to all of the young people in all of Latin America, but especially those in Puerto Rico. He goes on to say, never forget where you're from. This has been his message all year, and it's become a rallying cry, really, for all of Latin America. It's something that's really changing the way people see the music and each other.
Yeah, and of course, there's a political undertone given some of the other news this year. What are some of the other winners in the major categories last night?
Well, we saw Karol G take home, someone who is a well-known artist, take home Song of the Year alongside her co-writer Edgar Barrera, who has basically been one of the most decorated Latin Grammy recipients in the last few years. Spanish singer Alejandro Sanz also won Record of the Year. These are the awards that kind of went to the usual suspects, but there were a lot of really exciting things that happened down the ballot.
Such as what?
Well, two artists I absolutely have to mention, and they were also the best performances of the night. Our Argentine duo Catriel y Paco, they continued to build major energy like they have all year long. They took home awards for Best Pop Song and Best Alternative Music Album. I would play you some music, Steve. It's pretty profane, but you need to know is that they have this incredible magnetic energy. The other person I have to mention is Afro-Brazilian singer Lineker. Now, it's really important that she was nominated because typically Portuguese artists stay in the Portuguese category, but she was nominated for Album, Record, and Song of the Year.
Yet another breakout. Ana Maria Sayre in Las Vegas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Theme music inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
An extravagant 9-course meal, given the choice, would you pay $15 a person, $45, $125, same meal? We'll explain.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com. And by WSJ Plus, a news bundle offering global insights and market tools from 4 business and finance publications so readers can explore every angle.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, for a big company with a publicly traded stock, every quarter they tell you how they're doing. But for small businesses, there is no such requirement, so there are surveys. For instance, the National Federation of Independent Businesses Optimism Index fell in October to the lowest level since April. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The small business majority, which primarily represents firms with 1 to 10 employees, reports optimism is low right now. Brian Pfeiffer is VP of Research.
Business owners tend to be an optimistic bunch, but this year has been really challenging in terms of revenue declines and expense increases.
Costs are up for tariffs on imported goods and health insurance premiums. Meanwhile, Pfeiffer is seeing
a lot of headcount decreases among Hispanic-owned businesses, the impacts of immigration enforcement.
A rosier view comes from a recent report from small business lender Cardiff, which finds company owners
cautiously optimistic.
Cardiff CEO William Stern says there is plenty of anxiety about inflation and tariffs. Still, a lot of firms are poised to grow.
There's been a 25% increase by small business owners applying for capital, building a war chest. They're buying materials in bulk. They're doing more marketing.
Ariel Voorhees in South Burlington, Vermont, has been growing her personal chef business called Gather Round. She hired her first employee this year. She says some of her customers are struggling in this economy.
A personal chef is a luxury. Some families have had to stop service, layoffs in the family, or medical bills.
Still, with families getting ever busier, she thinks she'll have enough demand to keep 2 chefs cooking this coming year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Meanwhile, corporate bankruptcies are on pace to hit their highest level in 15 years, according to S&P data. Let's do the numbers. Yeah, stormy weather looking out the window here in L.A. Futures detect a downward draft on Wall Street. NASDAQ futures are down 1%. S&P futures down 0.6%. Bonds also down, pushing the 10-year interest rate up to 4.13%. And if you're in a position to save for retirement, here are some numbers for next year. The government has just increased the amount people can save in Roth IRA accounts from $7,000 to $7,500 in 2026. For people 50 and older, it's another $1,100 you can kick in. With Roth, you pay taxes now, but not later, even as the portfolio presumably grows over the years.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by JLL, providing commercial real estate solutions for investors and tenants around the world. JLL.com. JLL. See a brighter way. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at Schwab.com.
Now to pay what you can, fine dining. It's an experiment in New York City in the interest of sustainability, economic fairness, and great food. It's a pop-up, limited-time test of a restaurant called Community Kitchen, located in the Lower East Side Girls Club. One of its co-founders is Mark Bittman, the noted food writer and former New York Times columnist who joins us now. Mark, welcome.
Great to be here, David. Thank you for having me.
In your view, what is broken in our food system that you hope this place, Community Kitchen, helps to solve?
What's wrong with our food system is that it's not broken. It's working as intended, and it's intended to work to produce the greatest yield with very little or no intention of minimizing environmental impact or of positively affecting public health.
So some of it is about what you're serving, but it's also what Community Kitchen pays its workers, a living wage, $32 an hour, I think?
We would say that there are four or five different ways in which we're showing how a food system could be better. One is we're sourcing from local farms, from farmers who do things right. Two is, yes, we're treating workers with dignity and professionalism. That's very, very rare in the food system. Third is we're cooking really, really great food, also largely plant-forward, a lot of vegetables. And then building community, having people of different races, income levels, from different neighborhoods, et cetera, all in the same place.
Yeah, I mean, not exclusive. So what you're using is a tiered scale, same food, but, you know, the diner's bank account decides, can you spend $15 or could you spend $45 a person, or you choose $125 a person? I mean, does that encapsulate it?
I've been thinking about this project and working on it for years, and I can tell you that the most brain power has gone into that sliding scale thing. And at the end of the day, we decided we're going to have these three income levels, and it's no questions asked. People are going to pay what they think they ought to pay, because that's the most dignified and honorable way to do this, we thought.
I once talked to a New York chef who admitted that the traditional model of nicer than most restaurants was built on exploiting the workers.
If diners are paying $200 or $300 a person, then there's a chance that restaurant is legitimately profitable. But if you're going to source good food and pay workers well, and especially if you're going to charge some people more or less than other people, then your restaurant can't possibly be profitable. And that's the model for Community Kitchen, is we never intended to be profitable because we wanted, again, to show what it would be like when you take profit out of this equation, because then you can pay workers well, and then you can make sure that the access to this great food that you're producing is universal or nearly universal.
Mark Bittman, food writer and one of the co-founders of Community Kitchen, a new public restaurant in New York's East Village. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, David. Thanks for having me.
A pattern in our house is one of us cooking, the other enjoying, but asking, where'd you get the recipe? Very often the answer is that guy, two syllables, Bittman. Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our digital team includes Antoinette Brock, Emily McCune, and Dylan Mietnin. Our engineers are Rachel Breeze and Tessa Block. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, it's news headlines from National Public Radio here on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, Aiken, Hibbing, and Virginia, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 in Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota, and you can join us at KAXE.org. As always, a big thanks for helping us out through the crisis of losing federal funding last July. You are making it possible to keep this local source going, where there's always free information at KAXE.org. There will never be a paywall there. And we bring you the joys of our community. What could be more joyful than a breakfast with someone else? That's what we'll get today on the Friday morning show. It's What's for Breakfast coming up about 7:45. If you want to be the person to call, you can text us to make a reservation. 218-326-1234. News is next. It's 6 o'clock.
Good morning. President Trump is